Welcome to Ebogonautics, unveiling the Eboga experience for first-timers and shamans alike. I'm your host, AM. Today's guest is Dr. Chris Jenks. Chris has applied his background in organic chemistry to ibogaine extraction studies since the 1990s. Over the years, he developed simpler and less expensive procedures and manufacturing methods to extract ibogaine from various plant materials, resulting in multiple manuals and papers detailing the process. The driving force behind his efforts is to provide abundant ibogaine from alternative cultivated sources to people in need, especially those seeking addiction treatment. I invite Chris on the podcast to discuss his and his predecessor's contributions to non-traditional Iboga consumption methods. Members of the Bwiti religion have consumed Iboga for hundreds or perhaps thousands of years. Total alkaloid extract, or TA for short, and ibogaine hydrochloride are the result of Western extraction processes that drastically reduce the amount of wood product one needs to consume. In this episode, we'll hear Chris's perspective and discovery of Iboga alkaloid extraction and purification from the Tabernanthe Iboga plant species. Welcome to the podcast, Chris.
Thank you.
I watched your YouTube video entitled Chris Jenks Extracting Ibogaine. And for anyone who wants a very, very detailed, for someone who's not an organic chemist, I understood half of it. But if anyone wants to know like the full process, I recommend check out that video. You say in that video that you had two goals, or you probably currently have two goals. And one was to help people rid themselves of their addictions by making consumable Iboga products that prevents them from vomiting up said product that will help them. And your second goal was, after discovering this extraction method, your next goal was to wean people off of Tabernanthe Iboga. I've never taken root bark. I've never had that experience. Only TA. And I plan to visit Gabon one day to partake in such an experience. But would it be a fair assumption to credit you in giving TA extract to the world, like, I don't know, like the godfather of Iboga extract, so to speak?
It's a little hard to measure. You know, I did publish a procedure, I think it was 2002, on preparing TA from Iboga. It went in the Journal of Natural Product Letters, one of my few scientific publications. And I think a lot of TA on the market has come from that procedure, but it may not be the only procedure people have used. You know, I've seen techs out there where people extract the alkaloids, and it's not a complicated process. The one I published uses cold, you know, room temperature vinegar to extract a bunch of powdered bark, and then you strain out the bark and add ammonia to the vinegar and filter out your TA and dry it. So that's all there is to it, and it's very simple. But then I did a lot of experiments to try to come up with that very simple procedure. And so that's how I tend to develop my procedures, is I try a bunch of different things, and I try to do the simplest things I can think of because I want the final procedure to be easy to understand and easy to practice. As far as, you know, you mentioned that my goal was to come up with something that wouldn't cause people to throw up. And that, I don't remember that specific goal. You know, the advantage of TA is that you can pack it in gelatin capsules, so you don't have to taste the bitter Iboga going down. That's, you know, like, and that might prevent somebody from throwing up. But there's another reason to throw up, which is that the components in the TA could make a person nauseous. And there are things in the bark that can make a person nauseous aside from the ibogaine. And those things will probably still be in the TA. There was one experiment I did when I was refining the process for making the TA to publish in that journal, where I took the bark that had been extracted and I actually ate the bark and just find out whether it would do anything, because I wanted to find out if, you know, I was getting all the ibogaine and if there was anything else active in the bark. And I found that the bark didn't do anything. So that tells me that whatever's in the TA, it was originally in the bark. So I wouldn't expect it to make a person less nauseous than bark if they could get the bark down without tasting it.
Yeah, the taste is just, it's really extreme. I've only tasted it a tiny. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And actually, we discussed this bitter taste leading to nausea, which leads to vomit, in episode 2.6. I speak with a gastroenterologist on that episode, mm-hmm. Dr. Koch. And yes, well, I owe you and I said this before, before we started recording, a debt of gratitude, because if I had partaken in a root bark experience, then I probably not only would have vomited a lot of the product, but then I would have also probably not like to do that again. And so I'm on my current path because you came up with this method. Your Ibogaine and Vuakonga extraction manuals are just incredible sources of information, resources, touching on like plant material selection, how to furnish the laboratory, equipment, and the chemicals needed. Would you describe the extraction and purification process from start to finish in order to make TA extract and Ibogaine hydrochloride?
Okay, well, the TA, I've described that. That's simply the vinegar and the ammonia. And so it's very simple. But there are a lot of considerations, like how long to soak the bark, volume of vinegar to use, things like that, that are detailed in the procedure. But it's pretty elementary to make TA. And it's hard to mess up if you make sure that you don't throw anything out until you're sure you got the right stuff. The only caveat to that I can think of is that if you let it sit a long time, the thing can actually spoil. So I remember in Italy when I was doing some of these extractions, I actually had problems with spoilage of the bark if I let it sit for a long time during extractions. As far as the Ibogaine hydrochloride, I've actually discouraged people from making Ibogaine hydrochloride, pure Ibogaine, using TA or Iboga. And the reason for that is that the TA contains other alkaloids that seem to be active. For example, I was able to isolate at one time ibogaline from TA, and I tried that, and it was actually more active than Ibogaine. And so to try to separate out the other alkaloids and throw them away would be a waste of active alkaloids that may be enhancing the overall benefit of TA. But it is possible to get rid of alkaloids that may cause nausea. For example, another alkaloid in the TA is voicangine. And if you get enough voicangine, it'll really cause a bad gastrointestinal experience. But usually it's just a trace. But this voicangine is removed in the refinement of the TA. And so the refinement involves taking that TA and extracting it with acetone, and then adding hydrochloric acid to the filtered acetone extract. And that causes a purified total alkaloid hydrochloride to precipitate, and then you can filter that out and dry it. And it's a yellow powder, or the TA is a brown powder, and that gets most of the alkaloids, the active alkaloids from the TA, and leaves behind a lot of the inert material. But the voicangine doesn't seem to precipitate with the other things, so that also is separated.
Mm.
So and that's then, been another popular product. It's called PTA, and that's been another major product from Ibogaine.
And that stands for purified total alkaloid.
Right. And that's usually these products are considered complementary. So when you mentioned that you didn't throw out because you took TA, I would say that has a lot to do with dose. For example, when I was first developing the procedure for making TA, I was in Paris in an apartment in Paris, and I was with a friend named, what is his name? I can't remember. It was so long ago. I think his last name was Durbin. And we made some tea from the Ibogaine bark. We simply put the Ibogaine bark in a pot with some lemon juice and water and boiled it up and strained it. And we had some tea. And so that's basically the same bitterness you'd get from eating the bark. I found it extremely bitter, and it was hard for me to finish my cup. But my friend was able to, he said he actually enjoyed the taste of the same batch. So I think the bitter taste may vary between people. And I've noticed with other things like olives and other foods that some people find things bitter that others don't notice much bitterness from.
Yeah, I might have misspoken before. I did throw up when I took TA, but I didn't throw up because the TA was in gelatin capsules. I didn't throw up I didn't throw up the product, the initial getting it into my body.
Right.
Well, because I imagine that
go ahead. I was also wanting to talk about this complementary use of TA versus PTA. Because the TA contains things that can cause people to become nauseous aside from the iboga alkaloids, when it's used in treatment centers, they tend to use TA in the smaller amounts. Like if people want to take, you know, some maintenance dose or microdose, then TA is a convenient product and it's less expensive. But the PTA is popular when people are taking a flood dose because it tends to cause a lot less nausea than the equivalent dose of TA.
You also say in your YouTube lecture that TA toxicity is the same as in the root bark. However, isn't there always something lost or wasted during an extraction process? So like, what, if anything, is lost when one extracts iboga?
Well, I would expect a little of the volcan gene to stay. I mean, the volcan gene should be a little bit more water-soluble than ibogaine, just based on the structure. It has a polar ester group on it that ibogaine lacks, and so I would expect it to stay dissolved more than ibogaine does. But I also tested the extract, the water extract, after having filtered out the TA. I extracted that with petroleum to try to recover any ibogaine or similar alkaloids that were left over, and I got extremely little. So I don't think that there's a lot of loss. I think it's a very efficient process. But that said, there was a recent journal article by Felix Krangel at Krangel, the University of Mexico. It's a university
he's
in
going
Mexico
to be
City.
Yeah, he's going to be on the podcast as well this season.
Fantastic. His article was basically a test of extracting various plants with different solvents. And he said that when he attempted to extract, I'm not sure if he tested iboga, but he tested some Tavernae montana species that contained ibogaine, extracted his plant material with hydrochloric acid and compared that with extracting with methanol and found that he got a higher yield with the methanol. And so he concluded from that that not all of the ibogaine was getting out with hydrochloric acid. So I'm not sure how to reconcile that, given that, you know, I didn't find anything active left in the bark and I haven't had a chance to actually repeat his experiments to find out whether I too would get a higher yield with methanol. In a way, it doesn't really matter because even if there were a little higher yield with methanol, it isn't something that most people or even companies would want to pursue, especially with Volkanga, because the value of the extra ibogaine wouldn't compensate for all the cost and difficulty of processing all that methanol.
Do you think it has something to do with the instruments? Because your guides, you explicitly said that you wanted to make a technique or a process that actually used very simple, easy to access and get, let's say, cooking instruments or extracting and purifying instruments. Do you think maybe it has something to do with the instrumentation that he and his team were using?
Well, he used high-performance liquid chromatography for the analysis of his extracts to show how much ibogaine he got. And so that's a very, you know, that's a legitimate mainstream way to quantify yields. So I trust his numbers for that. So the things that are, you know, I'm not sure about is whether he had the same, you know, extraction conditions with acid that I do in comparing it with methanol. Simple things like that. Sometimes with plant material extractions, there's some, you know, you have to break the cells to get the contents out, things like that. So sometimes people freeze bark before extracting it treat it with sodium hydroxide to try to, you know, mush it up to get all the goods out of the plant material because things can get bound in it. Even the fineness with which the iboga bark is powdered can determine the yield because if you have chunks of bark, obviously not all the water can get into the pieces. So there's variables.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the historical timeline of extraction, iboga extraction. So the Bwiti have been consuming, we actually don't know how long the Bwiti have been consuming iboga root bark. And then, you know, TA extract and ibogaine hydrochloride come onto the scene, 20th century, especially in the early 21st century. Would you give us an historical timeline of the development of iboga and ibogaine extraction? Because you mentioned like Janot and Guterel, you mentioned, is it Dickel, I think?
Right.
Also, could you walk us through when people actually started trying to extract and purify?
My problem with being a history student is I'm very poor with dates. So, you know, I have a general idea. Mm-hmm. My understanding is that the first studies of Ibaga, I think the French were the first to be really interested in that. And they studied back in the 50s, I think, maybe a little earlier. And I'm just going based on what I gleaned from some publications. You know, there may be earlier stuff I'm not aware of. There was actually a university at France where it was one of the first places I went in my studies, because they were grinding up some Ibaga bark for us. That's when I was working with Karl Neyer. He's a German that was actually a chiropractor that was doing some ibogaine treatments at the time, and so he helped provide a place for me to work while I was developing that TA process. So we met in Paris, and that's where we ground up some bark and where I took it to do the first tests at that apartment in Paris. And anyway, at that university, they did extractions on Ibaga and, you know, came up with, they isolated alkaloids and characterized them. And they also had some kind of a medication that actually was, I forget what it was used for, treating smoking or as a stimulant, but I'm unclear about the how that was used. I can't remember the name of it either.
Is it called Lambertine or Lambert?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. And anyway, it was a low dose pill. It was some 10 milligrams or something like that. But it was, so I don't know the details of it, but that was one of the first things that came along. And then after that, there was Howard Lotsoff who came along, and that was the late 60s, I think, where he, you know, during the height of the hippies and stuff, he was one of the first people to get arrested for possession of LSD. And sometime after that, he, you know, was also a heroin user. He was offered a dose of ibogaine from a chemist, which was a very special thing back then. And so he tried it with his friends in an apartment and found that it completely eliminated his craving for heroin. And so he got off heroin, and so did his friends in his apartment. So that started his quest to make it a commercial medication. So he filed patents on it and encouraged researchers at the University of New York to study it. And so he did that through the 70s and 80s and 90s. He had a battle with Deborah Mash at the University of Florida, who at first offered to put it through clinical trials based on his protocol, and he signed a contract with her. And then I think after beginning phase two, she quit and ran off to St. Kitts and started her own thing, which she got away with because her husband's a lawyer. And so, yeah, it's quite a dramatic scene. And I think that happened in the 90s, I think, all that drama. There was also a weird publication. Well, there was a couple things. There was one by SIBA, I think. It was a patent saying that ibogaine could be used to potentiate opiates. So it was a patent saying basically that if you combine codeine with ibogaine, that it will allow you to use a lot less codeine to come up with the same activity. And that was, I think that was in the 80s. And the only other thing was a report about, gosh, what was it? It was some kind of a study by the DEA that they had, maybe not the DEA, but it was a study on prisoners that had been given ibogaine, and no details were given. But it was related to the DEA, and it was, you know, some people thought maybe they discovered that it treated addiction. That was part of why it was scheduled. But the story of it being scheduled, apparently, you know, the simple story is that apparently Howard Lotsoff himself tried to address Congress about ibogaine. Saying you should look into this, you should fund studies because it is useful in treating addiction. But when the Congress looked into his history and found that he had been arrested for possession of LSD, they thought, well, this is a ne'er-do-well. We'll just ban ibogaine along with LSD without looking into it. And so that seems to be its sad history. And that's restricted so much with ibogaine. Everything that is done has to be done outside the U.S. because of that. For instance, I went to France to develop the TA extraction and did some training in South Africa and also developed the process to produce ibogaine from Vuakonga in South Africa, all because of this.
You mentioned someone in the YouTube video, and I think in one of your papers, Dickel, something with lemon juice, like you use that as a way to extract? Sorry, maybe I misunderstood that.
Yeah, the lemon juice was my thing with, it was the guy in Paris that we made tea. Just simple lemon juice.
But does Dickel ring a bell?
It certainly does. Yeah, that was actually a very important study. He had some huge amount of Iboga. He had like 100 kilograms of Iboga, and he was doing a traditional extraction of it to try to characterize all the alkaloids. And he had such a ridiculous amount because he wanted to characterize even alkaloids that were there in a trace. So the content of his publication was mostly how he used the technology at the time, chromatography, and a bunch of extraction procedures to separate the large amounts of alkaloids in the extract. So he ended up with something like 1.5 kilograms of ibogaine, which he didn't want because he was trying to characterize everything else. But the way he got that was he had some alkaloid fraction and he dissolved it in acetone and then added hydrochloric acid. And he precipitated a bunch of stuff that contained most of the ibogaine. And so I thought that was very simple and useful way to do alkaloid separation on this. So I credit him with the central feature of the production of PTA from TA, because that's basically what it is. It's from his paper. But one problem I've seen with that is that there seems to be some side product, and I think it may be actually produced during this PTA procedure. The acetone is a rather reactive thing. In fact, if you take the acetone and the HCl that's left over and let it sit around for a long time, the acetone will start to polymerize from the hydrochloric acid. So I wouldn't be surprised if it can also cause some reaction to make a side product. And one thing, if you take the stuff that's still in the acetone and try to use that, because it's I call it recovered total alkaloid, the residue left from the acetone. And if you take even a small amount of that, try to get the activity, because that's where the other active alkaloids go to a large extent, it can cause a great deal of nausea that wouldn't have been, it's not able to be accounted for from the amount of TA that it was made from. So something new is being formed that causes a lot of nausea. And I think it's possible that that could get into PTA as well. So it's something to watch out for, and something I've always wanted to provide a way to avoid.
One of the questions I asked Dr. Kenneth Cook in episode 2.6 was maybe the nauseous feeling which leads to purgation is the simple fact that we're eating wood. I mean, it could be just that, right? It could be just that it's a very fibrous wood product. I mean, I don't think our intestinal tracts are built for eating wood. I mean, we're not cockroaches, so it's it could be just that, right?
That's true. Wood. I'm sure that contributes.
When I took TA extract for the first time, it was at a retreat in the Netherlands, 2017, and they said, "Well, we have the root bark, but it's a little bit more expensive if you want to go for the TA extract. Less, let's say, bad bodily feeling, you vomit less, you go deeper into the experience." Mm-hmm. When would retreats have been offering TA extract to clients? I mean, roughly. When would that have hit the market,
That's a good question. I mean, things were really slow in the 90s, and there was Howard Lotsoff, and he was trying to do his stuff in, I think, Panama. He was basically trying to come up with enough treatment research to get things kickstarted in the United States so he could get approval for running treatment centers. That was his life goal, was basically to get the U.S. to approve ibogaine treatment. And it was really, obviously an uphill battle since we're still stuck. I'm trying to remember how things took off. There were ibogaine conferences, and I'm trying to remember, one of the first ones I remember going to was actually a Howard Lotsoff Memorial Conference in New York. It was after he had died.
2012, that would have been?
Somewhere around there.
The Gita? Yeah.
Well, it must have been earlier than that, because Gita Conference was 2013, and that was one of the last conferences I've been to. So no, this was probably several years before that. But there have been several conferences, and that's where the treatment providers come together. And so those, you know, there'd have to be treatment centers before there were real conferences. I think it really started off as a freelance thing. You know, back in when I first started out, there was a treatment provider in the United States, and I actually got a chance to meet him, and he was just basically getting Ibogaine probably through Carl Nyer, and he was treating people in the U.S., although it wasn't legal, but he would, you know, do it in hotels and that sort of thing. Things were pretty simple back then, very basic. People didn't have a lot of experience, and not much was understood about the risk of a heart failure during the treatment. You know, it's extremely individual as far as whether that's a risk or not. So anyway, I think it started off like that. It wasn't so much that people had established treatment centers, but rather that people would come and an individual person would give them Ibogaine. The same with Carl Nyer. It was a one-man show. Sometimes he'd have a doctor help him out. And I think he had doctors screen people and that sort of a thing, but it was, you know, in his apartment at the time.
Now,
so I'm not sure how it with things being established.
Well, one thing is for certain, retreats were definitely offering it in 2017, because that's when I took it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's a good alternative if you don't want to have the root bark experience. Now, you mention potential extinction a couple of times in your text. And for example, you say in your 2002 paper that previous extraction methods require professional training. They're expensive because the main objective was only to identify alkaloids present. And in your 2009 Iboga extraction manual, you say, and I'm just going to skip around here, but you say, while the 2002 publication had the intended effect of increasing the availability of Ibogaine treatment for addiction, it had the unfortunate consequence of accelerating the approaching extinction of the Tabernanthi Iboga species. The purpose of this and associated manuals is to relax demand for Iboga root by providing abundant Ibogaine from an alternative cultivated source. Why do you think your extraction techniques are potentially accelerating such an extinction? Because I interpret your extraction research more as opening up avenues of scientific discovery that'll actually prevent Iboga extinction.
Yeah, you would think so. I mean, when I first published my work, the friends I had at the time were talking about this brilliant idea of going to Costa Rica, for example, and buying, you know, so many hectares and making an Iboga farm, which I thought would be a fantastic business. I mean, great. You get to go to a tropical country, be a farmer, a very simple life, and you sell something that, you know, a botanical product that has the value of silver. I mean, that's just great. You know, what a great way to get rich. And yet it never seemed to happen. Decades went by and nobody seemed to do this. And all I could hear was about people, you know, all the Iboga coming from mainly Gabon and some Cameroon. People go out in the jungle and they would scrape it up. I mean, you can imagine a bunch of people that are living on a dollar a day or less being, you know, very interested in something that has the value of silver that's sitting in their backyards. And so, you know, it had a big effect of what they called poaching, and people would go out and just harvest what they could and without much regard to it being sustained. So that was the big problem. And, you know, I've always been kind of mystified that there wasn't a lot more interest in growing the farms. Now, I went to Cameroon and I went to Ghana, but, you know, particularly in Cameroon, that's where there was the treatment center in South Africa called Minds Alive had contracted with a man in Cameroon, Christopher Ewa, to grow Iboga. And, you know, they paid for a plot of land. And I was supposed to be, you know, part of the reason for us going there, my friend from Gabon, Durban and I, we went to there to see how that farm was coming along. Apparently, it was a lot slower than we expected. I think it had been about 10 years, and apparently the plot of land had finally been slashed and burned because it was actually original jungle. It wasn't that big. It was maybe an acre or two. And the thing that was being planted on the land was a goosey, which is a squash that's grown for the seeds because the seeds are used to make a local food. I think there was one other thing that was grown there. I think it was the next crop to be grown on there was maize. And Christopher's explanation was that he was, I guess he was waiting for his iboga to be large enough to plant and just trying to use the land to get some money in the meantime. So then we went on a very painful scooter ride through the jungle to look at his iboga. And the iboga was maybe 10 square feet of seedlings that looked like they were a few months old. Yeah, so there was extreme, and he probably planted those because he knew we were coming after 10 years. So this is the amount of effort that had gone into that. Now, he was being paid to do that. I can imagine if somebody was just, you know, didn't have all that incentive and structure, that they'd have even less success in growing iboga. My impression when visiting Cameroon was that the reason that people weren't growing iboga was that everybody was very focused on practical, short-term, how do I survive goals. Everything seemed to be directed toward growing plantain and cassava, simple crops that everybody needed to survive. And the idea of growing a medicinal crop that would sit there for at least 5 years before you could even start to profit, I think that was just outside of their mindset. The other challenge was that even if somebody did it, they'd have to secure it for all that time because they'd be surrounded by a bunch of people that were very poor that would want to climb in and take something that was, you know, extremely valuable. And so that would be a huge expense right there. So I don't think, you know, that's the big problem. But there's other countries it can be grown in. I mean, you could grow it in Hawaii, and I'm sure some people do, but then it's not legal to grow there. But that's an example. I'm sure there's places in Mexico to be grown, and probably is.
Yeah, I think they are.
I'm just saying what's come to my attention. Sorry.
Yeah, I was speaking with, no worries. I was speaking with Yang Guignon, who's the he's the founder and co-director of Blessings of the Forest conservation charity, and he said that there's some attempts to grow to have iboga, I think Tabernanth iboga plantations in Thailand, Brazil, Mexico, maybe Costa Rica, but they're not developed enough to know whether these plants actually do contain the needed chemicals, right? The ibogaine and the other alkaloids. So we just don't know. And so, I mean, it's possible that that particular biome in central Western Africa, something about the weather, the insects, the animals, the soil, maybe that's what helps as well in the process of those alkaloids. But I have a follow-up question about your farm that you were thinking about in Costa Rica. Were you planning on bringing seeds from Africa to Costa Rica, or were you planning on extracting from other Apocynaceae plant species?
Well, if I lived in a tropical country, I'm sure I would grow iboga if I could. But I think I've got too much of a scientific curiosity to spend my life as a farmer. But, you know, there's a lot to learn as a farmer, especially with something exotic like this. You know, I could see it being, you know, a major hobby if I were located in such a place. But I never got around to really getting to move to a tropical country. There was still too much else going on in my family. But as far as farming, the contribution I made, a small contribution, was that when I was in Durban doing my research, I took the chance to obtain some seeds for iboga, and I chose several sources. And actually, the most successful seeds were from Canada. I wish I could remember. I think it's called Cerebus Extracts. And the proprietor was extremely generous. He actually had a greenhouse in Canada growing iboga, and apparently the iboga was old enough to bear seeds. So he sent me seeds from his greenhouse grown iboga. And the seeds were the most viable that I received. Even the ones I received from other places in Africa, you know, didn't grow as successfully as his. So that was the main source of plants that I tried to grow in Durban. And the reason I tried to grow plants in Durban is that Durban is located on the east coast of South Africa. But because, I'm trying to think here. It's in the southern hemisphere, I believe. And so the wind on that continent seems to come from the east, whereas in the United States, it comes from the west. So, you know, you could grow iboga in San Diego if it were legal. But Durban is about, you know, the same latitude as San Diego from the equator going the other direction. And so it's sort of a similar climate. So my theory was that because the winters are very mild in Durban, that you might be able to farm iboga in Durban. And Durban is one of the most, civilized places in Africa. And so it should be easier to secure the farm and find, the technology to farm it and that sort of a thing. And it did seem like my plants were doing well. I didn't get to stay through the whole winter. And the plants I left, apparently they lived a few years, at least one of them. But unfortunately, I didn't have the care left behind to take care of the plants. So I didn't really get to find out if they would have been successfully farmed for the multiple years they needed. But it looked like it would work if somebody were to set that up.
Yeah, I feel the same way about my podcast. I mean, am I in some way by raising awareness about iboga because my podcast is just about iboga. And so is that going to accelerate the extinction process? I don't think so. I think there are ways to give back. The easiest way is just donate money to Blessings of the Forest or, because they actually, for $30, you can sponsor a tree. Mm-hmm. And I do, on the introductory episodes for each season, I mention that I support this charity. I have a devil's advocate question for you about distillation and extraction. So modern extraction methods are obviously a Western twist to this iboga consumption and visionary experience. And I was reminded of this quote by a Sioux chief, Sitting Bull. And he said, quote, "The love of possessions," he's speaking about the white man, right? The European American settlers. He says, the love of possessions is a disease in them. And I thought to myself, okay, we're talking about extraction, purification. I wonder, now take out the possession part, but is there... So it seems to me that modern society seems to be preoccupied with extracting or distilling or capturing the essence of a thing. And the German philosopher Martin Heidegger speaks about the thingness of a thing, right? We seem to be looking for the essence of something, right? Through distillation, extraction, etc. How would you respond to a Bwiti shaman that says, "No, what are you doing? You should not, let alone you cannot, distill a plant's spirit," so to speak. I'm not saying what you're doing is wrong. I admire your breakthroughs and your discoveries, obviously. But yeah. I like to think, like, what would someone else say that is not, let's say, from the Western mindset or the Western culture, like you and I are?
Well, this reminds me of a famous story. I think it's Gordon Watson, something like that. I'm sorry if I'm getting the names wrong. I'm surprised at how poor I am at remembering names today.
R. Gordon Watson, the mushroom?
I think so. Exactly. He was 50s. In Mexico, and he was visiting somebody who was famous for treating people with psilocybin mushrooms.
Maria Sabina?
I think that was the very person. And he had brought with him some doses of psilocybin in a pill form, which he offered her. And she tried it, and was her report was that she was surprised that he had managed to capture the essence of the mushroom in these pills. You know, there's a lot of debate. You know, the debate goes beyond that to whether, the spirit of iboga is in ibogaine, if it comes from iboga versus if you make it from volcanga. Now you've stripped out the iboga spirit from the ibogaine, and so you wouldn't have the same experience. You know, as a chemist, of course, I look at the molecules and say, well, they're the same ones. You know, it shouldn't matter. And I think it is, there is a lot of psychology to that. And as far as extraction, it's hard to unlearn that, when we swallow something, it's extracted in our stomach and the wood part doesn't digest. And so making an extract in your stomach is the same process as if you had extracted the bark and lemon juice and just drank the liquid. It's just that you don't have to digest a bunch of wood. And
sort of like the cooking process, right? You're helping the stomach digest the food by cooking it.
Right. Yeah, that's a good, good comparison. I think we just can't unlearn what we know in the West. If we were raised where, you know, there is no concept of cooking or extracting or anything like that, then I could see how we'd have a hard time taking a pill instead of a pile of bark. It would seem like voodoo magic. But in the West, since we know these things, we can't forget them, and we have to build our own model of what's going on around what we already believe. Either that or we have to change our beliefs.
Yeah, I agree. Obviously, we have, I mean, in developed countries, we have our culture, our worldview, our ways. People in Gabon have their ways. And I don't think one way is better or worse than the other. It's just different. It's a different way.
Right.
Even though one contradicts the traditional way. Now, that example you mentioned about Maria Sabina being offered capsuled psilocybin by R. Gordon Wasson, have you heard of any Bwi tea taking TA extract or ibogaine hydrochloride? And if yes, do you know how they compared those experiences with their root bark experiences?
No, I'm sure there's much better experts about that than I am, but I'm not aware of that happening. Although I'd be rather surprised if nobody had tried that.
Yeah. I would love to hear an account of a highly trained Bwi tea shaman who has decades of experience with flood doses, but also microdoses, someone who knows the whole gamut, the whole spectrum of dosages, and then to take something. My guess with that is that it would be pretty similar.
I think so too. I think a lot of the effect of the experiences in the ceremony that they go through, and if the ceremony were wrapped around taking a pill every 4 hours instead of taking a mouthful of bark, then I would expect there to be a similar experience.
In one of your extraction manuals, you say that advances in chemistry in the form of like stronger acids might allow for more extract yield.
Right.
Since writing your 2002 paper, your 2009 Iboga extraction manual, and your 2015 Voa Conga extraction manual, how have extraction methods been advanced?
Very little, actually. The raw technology is extremely similar to what I first came up with, which was basically you dilute vinegar and you soak the bark for an hour and you squeeze out the bark, and there's your extract. But the one finding I had was, I think it actually came as a tip that I got from somebody, that if you use hydrochloric acid or a strong acid compared to vinegar, that the yield goes up because it extracts out a larger proportion of the ibogaine each time. And so I tried it, and it did succeed. And so I had to recommend everybody use stronger acid, hydrochloric acid, even though it's less available than vinegar, and it is obviously, you know, less safe to handle and less environmentally friendly. But that can't make up for the fact that, you know, you have to get as much ibogaine out as you can because ibogaine is precious.
Yeah, another thing I learned from your paper was this concept of a dust explosion. I'd never heard of, I didn't even know that was possible. Could you briefly comment on that?
Sure. Well, there's an experiment that sometimes you see in kids' chemistry experiments called lycopodium. And I forget what lycopodium is made from. I think it's a plant product. It's a very fine dust, a fine yellow dust. And what you do is you shake it up in a container and then set a match to it, and it explodes. It goes bang because the dust in the air is basically like a gas. And it's a hazard in places like grain silos, where you can have an enclosed thing full of dust. And so you have to watch out that it doesn't become an explosive mixture. And the same thing was when we were milling Voa Conga in a basically like a bathroom in a building. And the air became so thick with dust that it was an explosion hazard. So we had to find a way to reduce that dust concentration.
What's in the dust? Why does it explode?
It can be a dust of anything flammable. So flour, wood dust, you know, it explodes because you've got a finely divided flammable substance and mixed with air. So it's kind of like mixing a flammable gas with air.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. To your knowledge, how much ibogaine can the body take in one go? As in, like, what are the upper limits of root bark, TA, and pure ibogaine? I suppose it depends on the alkaloids present, but what from what have you heard? Like, I personally, I'm a little bit timid to go above a certain dosage just because of the cardiotoxic and other effects. But what, to your knowledge, what's the limit that you've heard people go?
Well, the main thing to watch out for with cardiotoxicity is the heart rhythm, the length of what's called the QT interval that you want to have screened before taking any significant amount of ibogaine. And then once you know that you're good, you know, you can take a pretty large dose. Back when I was developing the procedures, it was standard to use something like a gram and a half. Sometimes it would be related to body weight. You know, they'd give a milligrams per kilogram, but it seemed like a gram and a half was typical. So somewhere between 1 and 2 grams. At Minds Alive,
TA or of ibogaine?
No, of usually PTA or ibogaine. PTA was considered to have the same potency as ibogaine. And at Minds Alive, they were a little more conservative. It was more like a gram. But that seemed to be enough. But above 2 grams was considered rather reckless and unnecessary. So, yeah, it has a pretty narrow range that is, for flood doses. And then a lot of people have been doing microdoses since then. And I don't know what their protocols are.
Yeah, the reason I asked is because obviously you need less product if you're having TA or pure ibogaine. And so one could potentially miscalculate their dosage or even attempt to push as far as they can, which I don't recommend because, you know, it's not worth your life. And then, let's see, I have one final question here. Pound for pound, or rather kilo for kilo, how much ibogaine on average is in a kilo of Tabernanthi boga root bark, and how much is in a kilo of Voa conga africana?
Okay. Oh, I'm trying to remember. I seem to remember that ibogaine is something like 5 to 8% of iboga bark. And it's something like, at least active alkaloids tend to be maybe 30 to 50% of the content of TA. So TA is considered usually half the potency of ibogaine, or maybe even a little less. Because of the inert material. And when you make PTA and extract the TA with the acetone, there's, you know, a big chunk of material left behind. Usually the half that's inactive just stays behind, and the active stuff dissolves in the acetone. And the stuff that's left behind is completely inert. So when you make PTA, I actually took a good amount of the TA that had been extracted with acetone to show that there was no psychoactivity, no nausea either. It's just dust. You know, there's no activity in that. And then as far as Voa conga, the Voa conga contains usually 1% to 2% Voa cangene, although it can vary. And Bob Sisko, that set up the main factory to make ibogaine in Chennai, India, his initial batches were with a very poor batch of Voa conga, apparently. It was something like 0.04% Voa cangene. And so he got unlucky in sourcing his Voa conga bark, because the stuff I found in both Cameroon and Ghana was 1% to 2% Voa cangene, which, you know, it's lower than iboga. But since this is coming from an actual tree, which is also cultivated for the seed, so there's large crops of it already available, it's much easier to get huge quantities of Voa conga bark. And so that makes up for the, you know, few-fold smaller amount of Voa cangene. And then the Voa cangene is made into ibogaine that's about the same weight if you efficiently extract it out.
Chris, our topic today was about Tabernanthi boga extraction and purification methods, a little bit about the history, how the process works, your history with it, also your discoveries. What takeaway messages would you like people to remember from our conversation?
Well, I suppose one is that when you buy iboga products, try to look into how they were sourced. I mean, I've tried to encourage people to buy ibogaine that is made from Voa conga, because then you don't have to worry about whether you're causing the extinction of anything. The Voa conga is widespread across Africa, and the farms of it have more than enough bark available, and there's no no likelihood of causing an extinction if you use that source of ibogaine. If you go with iboga, then it's difficult to tell whether it was sourced from a farm. Even if they claim it was, of course, that would be profitable to say. And so it's, you know, trying to nail down the actual sustainability of iboga is difficult. But at the same time, if it is being sustainably produced, you'd want to encourage that by purchasing it. So that's where that is. Another, the thing that I've tried to tell everyone that produces TA, or particularly PTA, is to save the recovered total alkaloid from that process because it contains active alkaloids and they could be purified by a laboratory and sold separately. Also, I wanted to mention a couple of resources, particularly my website, puzzlepiece.org, which has the manuals that you've mentioned along with a bunch of other materials. And you mentioned that you saw one YouTube video of mine, but there should be several. I try to make all of the presentations at ibogaine conferences available on my website. I try to separately host the video files. So I have several different presentations there of my own with other people's.
Oh, excellent.
And the other thing is that on Monday, there will be a episode of Hamilton's Pharmacopoeia focused on ibogaine, or on iboga rather, and that a segment of that episode will feature my extraction of ibogaine from Vuakonga. And actually, I haven't seen the episode yet, so I'm told that it's rather, that's what was the word? It's a strange episode. So I'm interested in seeing what exactly was selected from our very long interview to show in that.
Is that how Hamilton and his crew described it to you?
No, that's strange. How a friend of mine that was sent a preview link described it to me. So I haven't had a chance to preview the episode, and I have no idea how it looks.
Wow, well, congratulations. That's really cool. I can't wait to watch it.
Yeah, well, me too.
Chris, thank you so much for coming on the podcast, speaking about this topic, and really another thank you, because I would not be on this path if you had not made the extract. And whatever I can do for you, man, I'll just let me know.
Well, thank you. And thank you for your interest in this.
The following is a disclaimer pertaining to the use of the Eboganautics podcast. Eboganautics is a podcast intended for entertainment purposes only. This podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional legal or medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified health provider or legal counsel with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or legal situation. Never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you have heard on this podcast. Neither Eboganautics nor any of its affiliates, sponsors, producers, guests, or hosts encourage the illegal use of controlled substances.